Good morning. We will open the Senate Committee on Revenue. So here's the order that we're going to go in. I think we'll look at Senate Bill 839 first, then do 847, and then end with 996. And as we wait for time, I will just announce the results from the we just got the results from the final four pool. So the significant thing is I've moved up from 13th to number 2, and my two teams are actually in the final four that I have winning it. The other significant thing, and I hope this is on in the Senate President's office, is our Senate President is now in 34th place out of 34 contestants. So I asked for this to be turned on to make the announcement.
And when you need to make the appropriate announcement, this is not for investment purposes.
Yeah.
It's not for entertainment only.
That is true. That is very, very true. And Kansas, who has the Senate President has winning the tournament, I think was out in the first or second round. There's no prospects of an incredible comeback. With that, we will open. So we'll open a. Let's do a work session on Senate Bill 839, and I'm going to call up a couple people. But Mary, do you want to refresh us on Senate Bill 839?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 839 actually has a proposed amendment that would change the sunset date from what was previously proposed as 10 years to 6 years. So the bill really extends the current sunset provision from 2006 to 2012 for a statute that provides a property exemption for multifamily rental units that are located in light rail station areas or transit-oriented areas or designated areas where the units are subject to a low-income housing contract with an agency or subdivision of this state or the United States. We previously discussed the purpose of the sunset provision and the extent to which multifamily units are rented to households that satisfy low-income criteria, and the chair asked for some additional information on that. The background on this bill is that current law requires cities or counties to pass ordinances that will provide property tax exemptions to owners of multifamily units if these units are located in either light rail stations, areas, transit-oriented areas, or the units are subject to some kind of low-income requirement. The exemption is for the property is for 10 years. I found out recently in talking to some of the planners in PDC that this actual statute came into effect initially with an orientation towards the transit and the light rail station to try to get people living outside the area into a situation where it would be affordable to work in the city without having to have, let's say, a car. And then later on, we added, the legislature added provisions that moved to number 3, which said designated areas where units are subject to a low-income contract. So there are some affordability issues that come up, but the primary reason for this particular statute was to move people or give people opportunities to get into the city to work less expensively. Okay.
Closer to the work. Great. Okay. So, committee, you remember the discussion we had around Senate Bill 839. We had a lot of questions around who is availing themselves of this property tax exemption, where are the projects geographically across the state, and I think the other one was just why such a long sunset. And so I've asked for the dash ones, which shortens that time of a sunset. And we've got folks who have come down to testify. So let's recess the work session for a moment and open a public hearing and bring up, I'm going to mispronounce your name, Ms. Tate. Is it Jean Tate? Mr. Wyman. And the next up will be Mr. McNamara and Mr. Lavendy.
Morning. Morning. First, which of us should go first? First of all, thank you for Mr. Chair and Mr. Committee members. And I'll point out that I have 3 of the final 4 in my pool right now.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, who are your what 3 do you have?
I missed on Duke. I have Illinois, UNC, and Louisville.
Ooh.
I'm surprised myself, frankly.
Good out.
But getting on to the testimony on this,
I'm from Eugene, City of Eugene, and Ms. Tate on my right is a developer in the City of Eugene, and she can talk herself better than I can. But I'll point out that Eugene, like many cities, encourages housing in its core area. And the true history of this, or not the true history, but originally this was a core area exemption back in the 70s or 80s, and then it expanded to the transit districts. But it really does support our overall land use goals and our adopted plans to invigorate downtown and encourage alternative modes of transportation. And this is just one of the very few tools available for us to encourage downtown housing. It's really more expensive to build downtown, and if a city wishes to encourage a sort of compact urban growth, it has to have something that levels the playing field between the cost of building in the core area and the less expensive cost of building in the greenfield properties. The developer must demonstrate that the project wouldn't happen but for the exemption. It wouldn't happen otherwise.
And how do you assure that? How do you assure, I'm sorry to interrupt,
well,
but that's
sure. We do look at the pro forma for the project, and we look at the construction costs, and we have some experience with housing because I'm also deal with low-income housing in our office, and we finance low-income housing projects. So we get to look at a lot of pro formas and finished costs for housing construction. So we really can tell whether the projects are making sense financially or not, how much the cost is per foot. And they make a pretty good case based on, and she can speak to that. Actually, you can speak to it right now if you'd like.
Our earnest money agreements on the project that we are doing in many cases says that it is contingent on our receiving the multiple unit property tax exemption. They won't buy unless it's there.
And Ms. Tate, we just need to get your name for the record.
Jean Tate.
From Eugene. And so we.
From Eugene.
And so you can say unequivocally that these projects, without this tax exemption, would not go forward in the form that they go forward.
Ours could not.
And I could say that with absolutely. Absolutely believe that. They would not be built otherwise. And in fact, we had the exemption, and then for a period of time after Measure 47 and 50 passed, we put a moratorium on it in Eugene. And during that time, we had no construction whatsoever of multifamily housing in the same boundary area. Once we lifted it last year, we had two projects. It just financially doesn't work out.
Senator George.
A few years ago, some friends of mine, Oregon Transportation Institute, and I believe some folks from Cascade, went out and surveyed, you know, the transit-oriented development in Portland. And what they found out was that instead of low-income folks who were using transit, you know, to get to downtown jobs, you had folks who were just looking for an opportunity to have low-priced housing and were parking their cars down the street a little bit around the corner. Is there any supervision or scrutiny of that kind of issue to make sure that we do have folks that need this, that are transit-oriented in their usage? Is there any scrutiny to make sure that we have performance in that area?
Well, you see, we don't have transit-oriented issues in Eugene. It's just the core area. We don't have a metro or a MAX. and so our boundary area is just in the downtown, mm-hmm. and it's all within walking distance of downtown. And so I can't answer that question. I can say, though, that the prices without this in the downtown would be so far out of scale with the rest of the community that it just wouldn't work.
And I can, if I may, can tell you that our project is people, my generation, I'm elderly by many definitions, don't feel that way, but I am, that we are coming to the point where we know that we can no longer drive cars, and so we need to be able to walk to the doctors, to the health center, to the those kind of venues. And so that's the reason I'm building this, because my husband and I want to live there, and so that's what we find. Probably fully half of the people who are coming in are people who will soon not be able to drive, and to be able to walk is extremely important.
Thank you.
Other questions for the panel as your state senator arrives from the good city of Eugene?
Hi.
Senator?
Great. Appreciate it.
If you have any other questions, I'll give them otherwise. I think
yeah, stay tuned. We're going to stay with this bill and bring up Mr. McNamara and Mr. Lazenby.
Senator Deckard, members of the committee. My name is Ed McNamara. I've prepared some written testimony, and I will go through it a little bit briefly rather than reading every crystal clear, stimulating word to you. But I was down here on March 10th, and I actually enjoyed the hearing. I enjoyed the questions that the committee asked. I thought they were thoughtful questions. So I went back afterwards and kind of try to pull some facts together to answer these questions for myself, you know, with an open mind. So largely what I've written today is in response to some of the core questions that came up. So I want to talk about three things. The purpose of the program, the amount of the tax revenue that is actually generated by these projects, even while they're receiving the abatement. I'll go into that in a little detail. And then how effective this program is as a way to produce affordable housing compared to other techniques that we have in the state. So those are three things I want to cover pretty briefly. You have it in front of you. The first point, the purpose of the program, at the last hearing, I think most of the questions asked about the affordable units and who was living in them and you know, how deep the subsidies were, and those are important questions. It's important to step back, remember, I think as you've heard, you know, since then, that this program is not primarily about creating affordable housing. It's about creating a middle-income housing often in central city areas that wouldn't have it otherwise. It's an effective program for that. You know, to me, and I've been in Portland since 1970, I watched the evolution of downtown. The real qualitative change in downtown happened when we started putting middle-income housing down there. The retail life came alive, the theaters, the movie theaters started opening, the restaurants are there. All those things are things that generate tax revenues and jobs. So there's an equity issue of letting the downtown workers actually be able to afford to live downtown, but there's an economic benefit generated by the multiplier effect of that type of development. So, but I'm not going to talk about those issues. I don't have the quantitative answers. You didn't ask about them. But so let's keep that in mind, that there's multiple benefits of this project, qualitative and quantitative. So I think that the two things I want to spend a little more time on that have a little more facts about are relate to some of the questions before. I think one of the questions that, or a theme, I think, of your questions was that we're giving up the property taxes from these buildings, and yet they are demanding services from the public sector, schools, police, fire, things like that. That's a good question. You know, what's the benefit of doing that? Well, what we have to remember this is it is only an abatement on the improvements on the site, so on the building. The land still pays taxes. So those taxes can be pretty significant on the central city properties because the land values are high relative to the land values in outlying areas. So after the hearing, I went back. I went to a website, LoopNet, that lists properties for sale. And I pulled up some listings. I tried to look for large apartment buildings on the outskirts of town, not in the suburbs, but out at 100, 120, somewhere like that, and looked at all the listings, all the financial data there, how much taxes they were paying per unit. And I tried to find some older buildings in the central city, so I was looking both at larger buildings and central city buildings. The average taxes on those properties were ranging from $381 per unit per year to $551 per unit per year.
These are the ones outer.
Yeah, those are existing apartment buildings. That's what they're paying in property taxes. The building that I have under construction has a property tax abatement under this program. It's in the Pearl District. It's affordable housing. The taxes on the land alone, even while we're under construction, we're paying property taxes on it, while there's no demand on services, are $38,000 a year. There'll be 210 apartments on it. So if the property was built now and was paying at that rate just on the land, which we'll pay for 10 years, it would be $183 per unit. So it's almost half, you know, it's a third to half of what existing properties are paying. So what we think of this as an abatement, they're still generating significant revenue to the district. Now, most planners and economists think that it's cheaper to provide those services in the central city where we already have the capacity and infrastructure than it is in outlying areas. I'm not going to go into that. I'm not an expert. But they are generating quite a bit. In the 11th year, when that abatement goes away, they're still paying tax on that higher land plus the improvements. So they're probably generating more taxes per apartment than those outlying. So we're given a 10-year abatement, and then for the next 90 years, we're getting full taxes or more. And so I think what you really have to wonder is, you know, how much are these generating? And, you know, what are we giving up in the short term? What are we getting in the long term? And that's not taking any other public benefits into account. This might just be a good investment on that basis alone to create those things in the central city where that year 11 through year 100 tax income will be so high.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Senator Brzezinski.
Mr. McNamara, you made a comment about basically the longevity of these type of projects, the 10 years and 90 years. Can you just tell us what is the lifespan for these type of projects normally?
Well, the one I have, I'm building, is a 100-year building. It's wood frame, but it's built stout. We put in stainless steel ties where the bricks go into the wood so that they won't break down, and we've really thought it's brick on the skin. It's a 100-year window in there, so it should be there as long as any other new building being built downtown. And my house is 100 years old, and it's built out of wood, and it's doing fine. And I tell you, it doesn't have the structural integrity that this thing has. So they should be long. So that's one point. The other question, and this was sort of fascinating to me when I went back to this, was the affordable housing question. Like I said, it's not an affordable housing tool, but it is used for it. So I looked at the list that the city had. Let me go back. There's two ways this is used to produce affordable housing. First is if it's a market rate building, the city's requiring a public benefit from the developer, and often that is to set aside some units as affordable housing. So we get some that way. The second way is a developer like me, a for-profit developer who doesn't qualify for tax abatement, wants to do an affordable housing building and gets the 10-year abatement. So there's two ways it's done. Let me talk about the first one. If it's just the market rate building and the Planning Bureau and PDC say you've got to give us how many units we're going to get affordable, now the city's actually requiring a certain percentage of affordable units in those. When they do those, they're subject to the same income restrictions, and they are monitored every year, and there's an intense monitoring process. It's almost an invasive monitoring process of people's incomes and assets, and everything's verified. That is an affordable unit for at least that 10-year period of abatement. It costs the city nothing but the foregone property tax revenue on that unit. If a nonprofit was building that, there would be no property tax on the improvement or the underlying land for that unit. And in most cases, as the housing folks here at the state of the city can tell you, there would be significant public investment of tax-exempt bonds, low-income housing tax credits, Oregon lenders tax credits, housing trust fund, PDC loans, sometimes in the central city, $30,000 or $40,000 or $50,000 per unit from PDC alone, not counting the other finite and precious state resources. So when the city of Portland is able to force a developer to provide an affordable housing unit in exchange only for the foregone revenue, property tax revenue on the building, it's an incredible benefit to the state to free up those other resources to be used in other places in the state that don't have Portland's resources. So that's number one. Number two is when a developer like me comes in and says, I want to do an affordable building with tax credits and bonds, and we're going to use those resources, but we also need a property tax abatement. I went back to the city's list, and about 25% of the units that have been done over the last 10 or 15 years fall into that category, where they have tax credits and bonds and PDC funds, which means those units have an income restriction for at least 30 years, and more lately in City of Portland for 60 years. So that affordability is there long after the tax abatement is gone. So it's a pretty good deal. In my building, we will pay taxes on the land at this $38,000 plus 3% a year probably for the first 10 years. And then in year 11, we're looking at paying about $220,000 in taxes on the full building. When I was applying for the abatement from the city, I went back and I analyzed this and said, what will we pay in property taxes, and what would a nonprofit pay in property taxes if they own the building? We have the same income restrictions, the same affordability restrictions for the same period of time. If a nonprofit owned my building, it would pay about $2.7 million in property taxes over the 60-year period. We will pay about $25 million in property taxes over the 60-year period. So it's about a $20 million difference. Even if you discount that back using a 3% discount rate, it's equivalent to about $7.5 million a day. So my point is that when the city is able to use this with for-profit developers on large projects, it's producing affordable housing at enormous value compared to what it would have to do otherwise. So if it's a given that we're going to produce affordable housing, this becomes a very powerful tool to do it. So that's my brief point. It's got larger purpose than just affordable housing. It's producing income during the abatement period at a pretty significant rate because of the underlying land values, and when it's used for affordable housing, it's really a great value to the state. So this tends to be, I think, the most cost-effective tool we've got, very low transaction cost, good monitoring, and I think it's producing great public benefit, so I urge your support for it.
Thank you, Mr. McNair. Questions for, yes, Senator George?
We have the Dash 1 amendments, which, you know, reduced the number down to 6 years. Does that affect what you're talking about? Because you've been mentioning the 10 years. Do you anticipate making any decisions based on that, or would you? I'm sure it's going to be re-upped. It'll be renewed, you know, in 6 years.
I'd rather see it be reauthorized for 10 years. I think the question came up last time. It's better to get it reauthorized for six than not at all. Mm-hmm. There are long lead times on these projects, so it's really the certainty for the developer planning. It takes at least 2 years to get one of these off the ground from the initial feasibility through the design and the permitting and then closing the financing, at least 2 years. And if someone, you know, and some of these have problems where it's 3 or 4 years.
Right.
So you've got to know the day you start your feasibility that that program will be in place. So what's going to happen is 4 years from now, people are going to have to start wondering whether or not they can count on this for a project they're starting in the fourth year because it might expire before they get their financing closed. So that's the limitation, is that it will put a hitch in people's planning 3 or 4 years out from now.
Other questions? Just, Mr. McNamara, so I think you've told me this before, but the one you're constructing, how many units is that?
It's 210 apartments, Senator Decker. 202 of them are affordable.
202 are
affordable. A third of those, 72 apartments, are affordable for households. The maximum income of the occupant is 50% or less of the area median, and the other two-thirds, the maximum income is 60% or less.
And you said it's an invasive process on income restrictions. I mean, not without getting into the how invasive. How did they verify incomes? Just with W-2s? And
no, there's... The bank has to release information on accounts. The employers have to verify stuff. So that someone comes in, they sign a stack of papers verifying or giving us permission to get that information.
So your testimony would be very, very difficult to
defraud.
To get away from.
Yeah, and we don't want that because the tax consequences to our investors if we ever have an ineligible unit are enormous. So our staff is trained. Our property management company has their own internal auditors that check all the files. Our investor has their own inspector who reviews all the files before they let us rent a unit up. Everybody. And then PDC comes down and reviews the files. Oregon Housing Community Services reviews the files. These places are inspected to death.
Okay. Chip Lazenby, how's your Final Four doing?
I needed Arizona to win.
Bad officiating.
So I'm done. For the record, my name is Chip Lazenby. I'm general counsel at the Portland Development Commission, or PDC, as we're pejoratively known from time to time. I'm in support of the extension. We think that this is a very important tool, a financing tool that we use for bringing private developers into the affordable and low-income housing market. And it has been an effective tool. We'll be supplying the committee with some data that shows that primarily in the Portland metropolitan area, we've used this for affordable and low-income housing. To Senator George's issue about the six-year extension, I think it's important for the committee as they adopt this amendment, and I hope this is a part of the record and that you do it as well, that you're extending the sunset for 6 years, but that the abatements that will be granted under the program will continue to be up for a maximum of 10 years. I think it's just because you've got the two time frames in there, it's important to keep those two concepts really, really, really separate from that. So basically, we support this. We think this is a great program. We use it extensively. As far as the accountability is concerned for the individual renters or people that are occupying those, there is an extensive process there, but I'm not sure whether previously there was testimony talking about what we're trying to do in the city of Portland to sort of safeguard the public fisc, which I think is what the committee is expressing some interest in as well. Our commission got us started about 3 years ago to, as we do our examination of the pro formas of the proposals that come through on the tax abatements, to really take a look at them and see whether or not they need the full 10-year of the tax abatement and start to stage it back to like 9, 8, or 7 years to see whether it will do that. Now, to date in the last 2 years since this has been in place, we haven't granted a 7-year abatement or an 8-year abatement. But we're certain that that's going to come in the mechanism for certainly highlighting those who are there. While we were doing that on the front end in terms of the analysis of making a recommendation to the council and the planning commission as they move forward with these abatements, your former colleague, Commissioner Leonard, who's now on the city council, has started a process on the back end of this that requires a look back on these abatements periodically, at least on after the first couple of years on an annual basis, to look at the internal rate of return on the projects to see whether or not the abatement is still necessary. And we've done that in the context of our program without any voting through the state statutes to do that. So we're really acutely aware that we're taking some value off the tax rolls. But as Mr. McNamara points out, the long-range investment potential of this and what it really does for a broad range of housing stock, if we were just to leave this just to the private market, you would end up with market rate only in a lot of these areas. And it isn't just the Pearl area downtown that's very highly visible that people constantly think of in terms of development. I mean, our abatements in these multi-family units spread throughout the metropolitan area and really serve a lot of low income and folks that really afford it. We talk about median family income, but the median family income for a family of four in the metropolitan area is $67,000. So if you're talking about people that are 50% of that, you're talking about really working people and providing, you know, housing stock for young working people and young working families. So this is an important tool to bring private guys like Ed in as well and not just rely on public financing for creating a broad strata of housing in the metropolitan area.
Thank you, Mr. Lazenby. Questions for Senator Starr?
I have a question. We've received compelling testimony of the effectiveness of this program, and I'm wondering why we would consider, other than the 10-year extension, why would we want to roll it back to 6 years?
That's a question for me. Not you guys can try to answer that, but and I'd like to see you definitely handle that.
What I would suggest, don't go there.
I'm not going to go there.
Senator Starr, my perspective, and we after the first hearing, although I guess I could be persuaded, certainly the will of the committee, if folks want to go 10 years, the reason that I asked for the dash one, which is a 6-year, was to me there were enough questions after the first hearing just in terms of who we were subsidizing, giving property tax exemptions to, and 10 years is a length of time that we normally don't extend out, although these are projects that are unique in terms of the planning. But to me, just for the accountability, I thought I would want them to come back in 4 years and talk to us about the numbers again in terms of who's availing themselves of this property tax exemption, where they are. And so for me, it was a comfort level and accountability measure to ensure that they're doing, and I'm convinced, and we had a long hearing that about 3 weeks ago, and this committee had a great many, many questions about the program. So as we move into work session, I guess I would put it back to the committee. If folks feel strongly that it should be a 10-year, then I wouldn't stand in the way of that. Though for me, I think on balance, a 6-year sunset just gets you, it brings folks back in 4 years to talk about the program and to ensure it's doing all the things that Mr. McNamara talked about and Mr. Lazenby and the folks from Eugene talked about that we want it to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else on Senate Bill 839? Okay, so we are going to close the public hearing, reopen the work session, and committee, this is a bill we've heard twice. What is your pleasure?
I support the dash one amendment, Mr. Chair. I like the idea of reviewing a lot of things we do legislatively and with a longer sense. I think you've struck a good balance between the idea of making sure that if projects are presented, that there is adequate time to go through the approval process and the construction process that is necessary to make those work. I also think, and I agree with your accountability issue, it gives us the opportunity to review whether we are still on track, so to speak, Ms. Bill, and still meeting the needs that we had made the assumptions originally, and in this case, in 2005. And if those assumptions are still valid, then I would think then that project, that program would continue. But it would be very, very difficult to make that alteration if, in fact, the sunset was too long.
In 10 years. Other thoughts? Senator Starr.
Well, my thought is that with the 2 to somewhat longer lead time necessary, if we delayed hearing until just 2 years prior to the sunset, we're perhaps deterring folks who might be stepping forward to build these projects from initiating it.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need probably need a 4-year look forward in order for developers to step up to the plate. And so I would hope that if we just give them 6 years, that we would look at this again in 2 years instead of waiting for 4 years.
Hmm. Well, that's a question. We can ask someone to come up. They brought this back to us. We're right up against the sunset right now. I think it sunsets, in January of this coming year.
Right.
So it would be up to the proponents of this. What I like about it, and it's kind of Senator Metzger's point, is it brings folks back to show us the data and ensure that we're getting the results. So we could ask the proponents if they'll be back in 2 years. Senator Brzezinski.
Mr. Chair, it just seems 2 years we're not going to have any data. Based on what we hear, it takes maybe 2 years for getting lining up your financing and getting everything going. To me, the alternative, I think the dash ones would allow us, we'd have to really act on it in 4 years. It's still 2 years out from the sunset you just mentioned, as compared to right now we're looking at it being 1 year out. If we're looking to, quote unquote, compromise between what the dash ones have and what the original bill, you can make it 8 years. And you can have them come back in 4 years, and you have the 4-year window that Senator Starr talked about. But it seems like at this point, we've not heard anyone saying that they're not going to continue moving forward in the planning. They're anticipating this bill is going to go forward, and it's only 1 year out from the expiration date.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm comfortable with the dash ones, but if the chair or the rest of the committee wants to try to compromise it out further, we can do that. The bottom line is, as we heard from Mr. McNamara, anything's better than nothing. This is something I think that actually gives us stability, and we're putting on the record that in 4 years, 2 years before it is set to expire, we're going to be dealing with it again.
Mm-hmm.
And it would seem at that point we're going to actually have data. 2 years out, Mr. McNamara might be able to come back and tell us how his project's going, but I'm not sure how many more are in the pipeline that can give us that feedback in 2 years.
Mm-hmm. So, Senator George, you are the tiebreaker here. You've got 2 at 6, so 1 at maybe 10, and 1 at 8. I'm flexible.
You're flexible.
What is your opinion?
Well, I am greatly gratified by hearing the accountability issues that articulated at the level that they are. And that was one question I had, is to make sure that, in fact, what we claim we're going to do, we're going to do. With that level of accountability that we had articulated, and with the fact that I have tremendous trust in our local partners to do a good job with the program, I would like to have, my perception is 10 years out there gives an opportunity for people that are really thinking about making this investment to say, okay, I think I can go ahead and move forward on this with a little bit more surety. But my thing is, one is better than none. Dash one is better than none. So I will go where the committee thinks is appropriate. But I do have confidence to extend that far out. And I'm the ultra-conservative here.
That's true. Paul, can we don't do conceptuals often, but can we change a 6 to an 8? And
I'll stay with 6.
You want to stay with 6?
Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator Metzger.
the reality is nothing prohibits anybody from coming into this building at any time and asking to extend sunsets again. I mean, they could come back and probably will next year wanting to change the 6 to a 10. I mean, there's no... the fact that we may want to look at this in 4 years does not prohibit them at all from coming back next year, and I expect they will be trying to extend it anyway. There's no mandatory. We can't hear from you in 4 years, so I think that is appropriate, and I would, and I think your well, and Senator Przanski's point is the fact of the matter is it sunsets now in 9 months, so if they come back in 4 years, you know, that's a year and 3 months sooner than they have this time. So I don't see that as a problem. I like reviewing these things.
Okay, so we got the, well, you haven't moved the dash ones. Senator Starr, any other thoughts?
I believe we're in work session.
We are in work session.
Well, I'm going to cede to the chair's wisdom on this, and I move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 839.
Senator Starr has moved the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 839. Any discussion? Objections to that motion? So ordered.
I move the Senate Bill 839. Are we going to the floor with this?
I guess to the floor.
Yeah, I move.
Kim is lurking, so when she lurks means...
Senate Bill 839 is amended to the floor with the DuPass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 839 to the floor with the DuPass recommendation, and before we do that, we have Ms. James lurking, and when she lurks, it usually means important issues.
I was just making sure we weren't passing the bill out with conceptual amendments.
Okay. We weren't, but now that you're here, we think we will.
Yeah, we do.
Just to show you who's boss.
We came darn close. I wonder how fast you ran to catch us from changing a 6 to an 8. Okay, so we could play a game here and start. Yeah, Senator George.
Dash one took 4 years off of the plan, and that took 4 years off her life.
That's right. That's right. We started. Okay, so Senator Starr has moved the Senate Bill 839 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Discussion. Any objections to that motion? No order. And anyone want to carry that? I'll carry it if other folks don't, since my amendment was the one that was adopted.
Be glad to carry it.
Senator Starr will be our carrier. Thank you for your help on that bill. Okay, let's bring up Senator Margaret Carter and Representative Gary Hansen and open up a public hearing on a bill we're familiar with from last session, Senate Bill 847. Mary.
Okay. Senate Bill 847 provides an exemption from property tax for a newly constructed single unit owner-occupied housing unit that is located in a city's distressed area. A single unit is a single dwelling unit that is occupied by a single person or family. It may be a single family detached housing unit, a row house, or a townhouse that shares a common wall with other similar units, or it could be a condominium in a multifamily building. A unit that's qualified for the exemption must have market value that is no more than the lesser of 120% of the city's median housing value or a percentage adopted by the city. A distressed geographic area is defined by statute as a deteriorated residential area that is unsafe and may contain a significant number of vacant or abandoned dwellings, the vacant lots or abandoned dwellings in it. Prior to the sunset date in 2003, this exemption existed, but only for owner-occupied, newly constructed condominiums were not exempt. I should actually clarify and say that what's going on here is that the exempt properties prior to the proposal pertained to properties usually that had an exemption for both the land and a building, the home and the building. What's going on right now in certain areas of particularly in Multnomah County, from what I understand, is that properties are being built in what is called an infill areas, You may have a single-family house on a large, deep lot that maybe previously had a septic system. So the lot is very deep, and it leaves a lot of vacant land back there. Some of these areas have since been serviced by sewer systems, which means there's a lot of land that could be used for other development. But when buildings are being put up, presumably multifamily dwellings that are being put up on these in these infill areas, the land is not being sold. So you have a right to the property, but not to the land. Well, that's what this particular bill will do, will add those types of properties that you don't own land to. So a condominium is an example of that. And it could be a low-rise multifamily dwelling going in on this, on a driveway, a deep driveway, where the back of the property is vacant. Previous to this, we had an estimate of, it's roughly similar to my own, and prior to the sunset date, the Department of Revenue's exemption report estimated that the exemption, excluding the condominium issue, was about $2.8 million. And I've used that data to expand it to include presumably the amount of building that would go on with additional condominium construction. I've basically factored it up by about 10%, and that may be too high, but I think it's the estimates I've given you for 05 or 07 are slightly lower than what was given to you before, because I think it's more of an infill type project. It's not based on any ratio, let's say, of multifamily units to single family units statewide. It's a very particular type of development. That's it.
Thank you. Questions for Mary?
Good morning.
Good morning, sir. I'm Margaret Carter, House Senate District 22, North Northeast Portland. With great respect to legislative staff, our understanding about this bill is different, and I'd just like to give some opening remarks and then yield to my colleague in the House from North North Portland, North Northeast Portland, and then to have Ms. Kapori explain the bill in terms of our understanding of the bill. So with all due respect. Mr. Chairman, I'm pleased to sponsor this legislation today. I am pleading and begging and being on bended knee that you will not allow this bill to go the way of last session. This bill is vitally needed. In our community, we have 98 to 98.5% occupancy rate in North Northeast Portland, and we need to build accessible housing. We also need to deal with housing along the light rail line where there is availability of space to be able to build, to do infill housing along those lines. And so I strongly encourage you to act promptly to move this bill to the Senate floor. Senate Bill 847 comes to you with a due pass recommendation from your General Government Committee. You may remember in 2003, this legislation received near unanimous support on the Senate floor. For the exception of politics, our bill would have gone to the House where hopefully it would have passed, but since it did not. Earlier this year in Portland, you held hearings on housing affordability, and you've been looking at how we can make home ownership more available and accessible to all Oregonians. Senate Bill 847 is one way. This is a very successful program that has proven track record in assisting low-income and moderate-income families to home ownership. One success of this program, and I would like to personally invite you to visit North Portland to see it, is the Host Development Project at Charleston Place, a 99-home subdivision in the St. John's neighborhood. It is a beautiful, affordable community built in the old Portland style that includes 3- and 4-bedroom homes. Host, Inc., a home ownership, a street at a time, is a Portland-based nonprofit organization working to create home ownership opportunities and to strengthen communities. Since 1991, Host has helped to build about 1,800 modestly priced homes in neighborhoods categorized as economically depressed, including hundreds of homes in North and Northeast Portland. Another project you may know is Rosemont, a development of 50 single-family homes built by Walsh Construction Company in North Portland's Piedmont neighborhood. Another group that has used this program is Habitat for Humanity, which has built over 100 homes in Portland. Currently, one out of four Oregonians is unable to afford housing. Tens of thousands of Oregonians every day face the hard choice of paying for a roof over their heads and less food on the table. Home ownership is the American dream, and I need not tell either one of you sitting before me how much of a dream it is for so many families. But incomes are not always keeping pace with housing costs for many families, and we need to do what we can to assist localities and communities that want safe, affordable, attractive, and well-designed housing consistent with local policies. This is a program that the Oregonian calls one of the most successful builders of homes for people. I ask you to join me, and I ask you to please, please help be supportive of opportunities for people who are now without access to homeownership by passing this bill out and using it for very constructive means. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
Thank you, Senator Carter. I do recall this bill very well from last session as one that enjoyed unanimous support, or just about unanimous support, and got linked to another issue, and unfortunately was one that did not make it out of the legislature, but one that was not encountering opposition. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee. Gary Hansen, State Representative from House District 44. Actually, I don't remember this bill from last time because I was in the House.
That's right. But that, get to you.
I had an opportunity before I came to the legislature to serve as county commissioner in North and Northeast Portland for 8 years, at a time that this program was being incredibly active and made a huge difference in North and Northeast Portland. We donated a great, well, in 1990, it's hard to even conceive of this now. In 1990, Multnomah County had over 700 foreclosed properties in inventory that had been to auction, and basically were properties that no one wanted to bid on, that you virtually couldn't give away. But we did include them as an in-kind donation for the Nehemiah project that was part of this movement of a combination of tax abatements as well as donated foreclosed properties that created, I think, within a matter of a few years, 150 very high-quality, low-income housing stock. And I was able to go to a couple of the move-in parties and celebrations of the thrill that we were giving people that they could find affordable housing was just incredible. That, and it's hard to go back and say, identify each and every factor that was available in the turnaround in North and Northeast Portland. But certainly that infusion of quality homes in some neighborhoods that were really struggling has helped to make a dramatic change in how those neighborhoods work and function and improve. Building one of those houses on a vacant lot or an unimproved lot, the neighbors next door would respond by remodeling and fixing up. And you could just see it virtually month by month as you drive through some of those streets, as the infusion of new families and new activities and new people coming in created not only some economic viability, but it also created a great deal of hope. Anyway, this is vitally important for North and Northeast Portland now. The situations have changed. It's no longer the depressed area that it was. Now it's the bigger problem is affordability and getting people to be able to afford a home in some of the same neighborhoods that they've lived in for a long time. However, the model that was used to turn Northeast Portland around may very well be needed in some of our older suburban communities as poverty changes and spreads and possibly in areas like Rockwood and some of the other suburban places. This may be needed at some point in the future. It's probably needed now. Anyway, this is a great bill, desperately needed, And I hope to see it in the House this time.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown and Representative Tomei are sponsors of this bill as well, because there's properties in Milwaukee and in southeast Portland that want to use this concept to redevelop housing in lower-income communities in southeast and Portland and southeast into Milwaukee area as well.
Well, where are they then if they're...
They were in committee, and we told them we carry the water today. So.
You did it well. You did it very well. Questions for before we move to Ms. Kafori? Ms. Kafori.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Marge Kafori, representing the City of Portland. Actually, this is our third session trying to get this bill renewed. We started this effort in 2001 with House Bill 2908, which flew through the House, which came over to the Senate, which landed in Senate rules and became embroiled in a river issue, let's just say. In 2003, we started this bill in the House. It flew through the House Revenue Committee, passed the House virtually unanimously, came over here. Passed out of the committee, came back to Revenue Committee for some drafting corrections, passed the floor, went back to the House where it ran into some trouble. House refused to appoint conferees to a conference committee to resolve differences between the House bill and the Senate bill. We then amended a Senate bill and put the contents of this bill into the Senate bill at the last few days of the session. It was stranded on the Senate President's desk at sine die. So we're now introducing it again in 2005, Senate Bill 847. We hope to get it through the process this year without it getting stuck with something completely extraneous that doesn't have anything to do with the merits of this program. I'm going to ask in a minute for Brian Morisky, who administers this program for PDC, to come up and very briefly explain what it does. But to the point about how it actually functions, what we have to do in the city or any city that chooses to use this program is to go through a process that identifies and designates specific distressed areas in our community where these projects can be built. So they cannot be built just anywhere in the city of Portland. They have to be built in areas that qualify as distressed urban areas. Those currently are areas in north-northeast Portland and in southeast Portland. Excuse me. So that tells you that there are some geographic restrictions. We can only designate up to 20% of the land area in Multnomah County for distressed area housing, but they are restricted to those specific areas that we are trying to stimulate with affordable housing so that we can re-encourage families to come back to those communities and make investments there.
Ms. Kafori, I'm going to let Representative Hansen and Senator Carter leave if they need to.
In committee. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, thank you.
Not that we want to.
Well, you can hang around and even sit up here if you like.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Is it 14, 15, or 20?
14%.
Now. Right. Yeah. Okay, well, we'll get into that. And then the other thing is the reason that we wanted to expand this to include condominiums is because simply that condominiums in this program are considered to be owner-occupied housing that shares walls. And those kinds of units are much more affordable to build oftentimes than single-family detached housing. So that's the only reason that we're expanding the program definition to allow for the qualification of those kinds of units to be built as well. So with that, unless you have questions for me at this moment, I'd like to introduce Brian Morisky, who is with the Portland Development Commission.
Senator Metzger.
Thank you. I have a question, Marge. We have talked in this committee about a lot of different exemptions and programs, and one of the discussions that we have had, it's been a theme that we've kind of weaved through some of these, is asking folks regarding the school issue. So I'd like to ask you about that. In terms of an exemption, and certainly the city of Portland is facing, and the mayor has talked about, you know, the children being the number one priority, and we have to do something about school funding. But as we do this very worthwhile program and we encourage families to be there, we also try to educate them with less and less money all the time. And wondering what your thought is on if this program were to go to be reenacted and go forward, whether that exemption, whether we would exempt the public school portion of that tax from the exemption, so that we do have some monies to help educate the kids that will be in these houses. And I'm just curious as to your thought about that, because, you know, as we continue to have, as we're successful with this program, having more kids, and we have less and less money for Portland Public Schools, then, you know, I mean, it squeezes out somewhere else, and I wonder if the school tax should still be levied.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger, thank you for the question. I understand the thread of your thinking here on the committee because I've heard that discussed before. First, with respect to how the bill operates, we are required to get a 51% of taxable value permission from other taxing jurisdictions. City of Portland represents about one-third of the overall taxation rate in the City of Portland, so we are required to go to our other taxing jurisdictions and get their permission, which we do. We've kept all of our taxing jurisdictions in the loop about these abatement programs throughout the years because we believe it's important that they are participants, that we're not simply forcing something down their throat. With respect to foregone revenue, we're really not foregoing all that much when you consider the school district's $5 as opposed to the whole amount, where I think we're currently taxing at about $22 a thousand, given everything that we have on the tax rolls. And the district is about five or six of that. I think they have a little bump for the extra property tax thing that they have right now. But where they benefit is that we are bringing families back. And as you know, we've had declining enrollment in the City of Portland. We're now closing schools. What we do with this program is to enable families to afford to live within the city and not have to move out and to raise their families in those areas of town. So I think bottom line is that there is a benefit to the school district for re-encouraging families to come back to those schools rather than have those schools be under-enrolled or sitting empty. Because when they're under-enrolled, they're very cost-inefficient. Mm-hmm. And when we have adequate enrollment within those schools, it makes them work better. So I think that, you know, counterintuitively maybe a little bit, I think this is a program that benefits the district.
Okay.
Good
morning. Chair Decker and members of the committee, I'm Brian Mariski, and I'm the program administrator for limited tax abatement at the Portland Development Commission. And I just wanted to run through some of the criteria for the program and some of the benefits for affordable housing. And Barbara Sack is here. If I have the follow-up questions that she may be able to answer.
Let's bring her up if she's here to help. Do you have anything visual for us in that big ream of papers, Ms.
Could you
like
a map of it?
Sure.
Hey.
Okay, go.
You have a copy?
You know,
I'm passing up,
like you
happened the last time,
but
just one this time. So
okay, we'll pass it around. So just go ahead and kind of give us the constructs of
The program. These are 10-year tax abatements, and they benefit the homeowner. They abate the improvement value, but not the land. The homeowner will still pay on the land, and they can also have increases on the assessment of the land during the term of the abatement, any increases that would have been allowed under Measure 50. The single-family abatement program originally was passed by the 1989 legislature. Its original intent was to promote infill development of vacant and abandoned properties in the designated distressed areas. So these were properties that were on abandoned lots, underutilized lots, and in distressed areas. And over time, these areas have improved, northeast Portland. So the program and other market forces too created a success in redeveloping these areas, and so this program now really is used as a tool for affordable housing. And it currently has a price cap of a home sales price for $170,000, and the maximum family household income is $67,900, the HUD MFI for a family of four. And under recent amendments to Portland's program, the homes also need to be owner-occupied for the term of the abatement to maintain that abatement. So I'm really urging you to reauthorize this program. I I'm the person who gets phone calls from people that want to apply for this program. Originally, I thought this allowed people to buy more of a home, and now I absolutely know that this allows people that would not otherwise be able to be homeowners to buy a home. So I think this is a very vital program, and I'm urgently asking that we reauthorize this program. And I'll take any questions.
Thank you. Questions? So what are the ramifications of having a program that's been down now for a few years, and how do you, and Marge is wrestling on this one. So.
Mr. Chairman, I would refer you to Section 4 of 847, which is in the new language, contains Section 10, I apologize. Section 10 of the bill has a look-back provision. In other words, when the program sunsetted, there were some stranded applicants and who had made an application to, in one case, the city of Milwaukee, in another case, to us for you know, the abatement. They became stranded applicants. So there is this look-back provision that allows us to process those applications. The abatement would not be a retroactive abatement. The abatement would be effective as of July 1st of 2005, which is the tax year, beginning of the tax year for 2005-2006. But we would be able to process those applications that got stranded between the sunset date and now.
So how many folks were stranded?
I don't have an accurate number on that. I have a contact list of people that I've pre-qualified that would otherwise have been granted that abatement, and it's about 230 people
that they're moving forward anyhow without the abatement.
They're homeowners now. Some of them will say, I don't know how, actually a lot of them will say, I don't know how I'm going to be able to afford this house without this. A lot of people wonder the idea that they could get this abatement. They didn't know the program was down. I've also had other people that for other reasons they won't meet the criteria of the program. Maybe they're outside of the area. They didn't know that they had to be in this mapped area. But in most cases, when I speak to people on the phone, that they find out that this program is down, and they say they don't know how they're going to be able to afford this home. So we've had one serious case that we look and we really tried to find something for them, but there simply are no provisions to do anything if somebody has an application. And after the sunset at the end of 2003, there was nothing we could do for this person, and she was living without her power on, so we were trying to do something to help her. So these, I know in a lot of these cases, these are people that this makes the difference between them being able to own a home or not.
And the look back would only apply to those cases that, I mean, what is the, I guess, the structure to ensure that you're only looking back, if we do adopt this, the look back would only be for those folks that have applied, that are in the process, so that you couldn't kind of reinsert yourself into that period where this program was down.
All right, Mr. Chairman, Section 10 reads, an application that seeks a tax year beginning on or before 2005 may be approved or denied if the application is pursued. First tax year, the exemption should be 2005. The intent here, and I believe it's contained somewhere else in the legislation, is that you already would have had to have been in the queue. You couldn't put yourself in the queue now. In any event, the abatement itself is not retroactive. The abatement starts in July of 2005. But these are people who either bought a house that was qualified under the program, or with the understanding that we were going to be able to offer the tax abatement to them, and they were already queued into the system in some form.
In the city of Portland's code, also, you have 2 years after the final OK to occupy permit date also to apply. So that would only allow us to back up to that extent.
Okay. Questions for the panel? Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate the time. So just encourage you to meet with the members of the committee and get a sense of where folks are at on this bill. Anyone else on Senate Bill 847? Public hearing on Senate Bill 847. open a public hearing on Senate Bill 996, which is the lender's tax credit, which we heard a great deal about previously, but I wanted to bring this back for its final public hearing, and we won't go into work session on this bill today, but have it ready for work session with this second public hearing. Thank you. So this is a lonely feeling, Paul. No one is. Elizabeth is on her way down. Well, let's bring. I'm not used to not having my our folks here next to me on my right. Bill, do you want to come up and maybe Mr. Croft, Mr. Van Vliet, Mr. Croft, and begin just an abbreviated version of what we did in Portland, walking the committee through the bill and getting us ready to perhaps vote. Wow. Well, all right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Phil Donovan. I'm here on behalf of the Association of Oregon Housing Authorities and a member of the Oregon Housing Alliance. Thank you very much for bringing this Senate bill for a public hearing today. We're here in support of Senate Bill 996, and to my left and to my right are a couple of experts on the application of the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit. Bill Van Vliet will establish the use of the tax credits and how it works and kind of provide a macro picture. Jerry Croft, to my right, will take you through its application on some specific properties here in Salem. We've circulated some photographs of the properties that Jerry will be speaking of for some visual aids, as well as some of the specific dollar figures by which the housing tax credit helps provide affordable housing. So with that, I turn to Mr. Van Vliet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Bill Van Vliet, and I am the Executive Director of NOAA, the Network for Oregon Affordable Housing. And we're in Portland. We are a nonprofit consortium of Oregon banks that finance affordable housing projects throughout the entire state of Oregon. We were formed in 1990 and have made about $100 million in loans statewide, and that's developed over 4,000 units of low-income housing projects. First, I just wanted quickly to respond to a question I think, Mr. Chair, you asked in our Portland session, and that was, you know, I think you put to us what was the appropriate role or one role that the state should be playing in meeting the affordable housing crisis we have in the state. And I've thought about that a little bit since then, and I really think that, especially with the state budget and the economic times that we have, we really need to focus on programs that leverage private capital in the most efficient way possible. And to be honest, I think this Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit Program does that very well. We certainly have an affordable housing shortage here in Oregon, and I know others will speak more directly to that, but one statistic I'll throw out is that the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco published some economic research within the last couple of months that showed Oregon with the 48th least affordable rental housing market in the country. And we also have the ninth worst home ownership rate. So we certainly have some ground to make up in providing affordable housing for our citizens. The OHTC, I think, is one of Oregon's most successful and powerful tools to help developers create housing that's affordable to our lower income households. And how it works, I've handed out some material, and I hope it's worked its way around. I'll briefly walk you through sort of the mechanics of it. But the OHTC allows banks to reduce their interest rate on loans and organizations like NOAA by 4% in exchange for a state income tax credit equal to the lost interest income caused by that lower rate. And property owners then agree to pass that lower debt service cost on to the tenants in the form of lower rents. And on page 2 of that, I give you a couple of graphic examples of an analysis. And the first box on the left shows a project without the OHTC. And you can see that with this project would be able to provide units that are affordable to people at 45% and 50% of median income, and I showed the corresponding rents next to that. And just by way of reference, down at the bottom of that page, I give you what those median income ranges are, just so you can get a sense of what that is. If you're able to apply the OHTC to that very same project, what you're able to do is to take those 50% units and reduce the rents by $260 a month, and then they become affordable to people at 33% of area median income. That's a significant rental reduction going straight to the low-income households in Oregon. The way that works then is that that lower income is offset by lower debt service from the lower interest rate, and so the project is able to borrow the same amount of money and serve a much lower income population in that same project, which is the whole key to the program. And then just by way of example, because I think it's important to note, that if we wanted to serve that same population that we serve with the OAHTC, but with not with the benefit of the OHTC, so we had the regular market interest rate, we would have to reduce our loan on this project from $1.4 million down to $900,000. That creates a budget gap of $500,000 that has to come from somewhere to make that project feasible. So you can see the power that this program brings to projects, both in the form of lower rents and also providing that private capital to finance the construction of the project instead of some other public subsidy program.
I think you've answered this before, but is it done contractually to guarantee the lower rents with the property owner? Is it just by signing of a contract?
Yeah, the state, the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department executes a written agreement that's recorded against the deed of the property that requires the rent pass-through, and they do check for compliance on that. And that's really one of the great things about this program is it's delivered through the funding, the funders, the private lenders in the project, but all of the benefit goes to the tenants in the form of lower rents. The lenders don't get any benefit out of this. The apartment owners don't get any benefit out of this. It's all in the form of lower rents for the project and for the tenants. And that is, to me, that is one of the important things, is because these credits, unlike many tax credits, are not discounted and sold. And so 100% of the tax credit, and in some cases, most cases, more than 100% of the tax credit, goes to achieving the public policy objective. And that's a very rare program that I've seen in financing affordable housing, or really any public program that's out there. So it's very efficient and very powerful. The way you can see that we deliver more than 100% in many cases is if you look at that middle chart on the project with the OAHTC, you can see the rent savings are at $44,000, yet the reduction in the debt service is $41,000. And so, I mean, the amount of the credit is $41,000. And so they're actually achieving greater rent reductions than they're claiming back in credit. And this happens for a number of different reasons, but most projects like to have a little buffer put in to make sure they're in compliance when they go back every year. In most of the people who use this program are mission-oriented developers, nonprofits, and they really do strive to make their projects absolutely as affordable as possible to low-income tenants. This program is so I talked about efficiency on leverage. This program leverages private capital at a really phenomenal rate. Every $1 million of this credit that's claimed leverages $25 million of private financing. In NOAA's experience within our portfolio, that then translates into $75 to $100 million of project development costs that these projects then invest into communities. So there's tremendous leverage all the way up the chain into your $1 million investment generating really $75 to $100 million of private capital investment into local communities around the state. And that's a very powerful multiplier effect. And that's creating jobs in communities as well as affordable housing, which is where we get, you know, really two great benefits out of this one program. The current cap's at $6 million, and we're at that level right now. As a result, projects have been receiving partial allocations through this most recent year, and there will be very few allocations available moving forward if we don't increase this cap. And the proposal that I think has been discussed is to raise that cap to $11 million. The other thing that's important is that there's a sunset provision, like you've just been talking about, and we would like to see that sunset provision extended out so there's some predictability with this very successful program for funders. And again, we've talked about the long time lags, and that's important here. And I show that to you on that third page, which has a graph of how we would project the credits to be sort of phased in if the cap is increased to $11 million. And I want to start out by showing that if you look under the end of 2004, well, let me tell you what these two lines are. The top line are credits that are available to be claimed, and then the credits that are set aside for projects that are under construction but haven't been placed into service yet. The bottom line is only the credits that have been that are available to be claimed, and then the projection with the increased cap, how that would work. And what you see in 2004-05 is that those lines nearly meet. And what that is showing is the fact that the state has had to, Oregon Housing Community Services has had to slow down their allocations. These other projects in the pipeline have come online, and those two lines are about even right now. Normally, we would see a more typical spread between those two during that period. So coming out of that, you can see that bottom line doesn't increase as fast as the upper line. So we're starting to reserve projects again to get them in the pipeline because, again, there's about a two-year lag between the time somebody receives an allocation and the project is placed in service and the credits can be claimed. And so we're going to spend 2 years really working out of the fact that we have sort of had this pinching effect with reaching the cap. And then those lines will start stair-stepping up in a more traditional and complementary fashion where the two lines are at the same trajectory.
So at $11 million, the program is self-sustaining.
And at $11 million, the program becomes fairly much self-sustaining to some historical levels. So it'll have about $1 million per year then becoming available through loan repayments every year once we get to that level. And so that would then correspond back to some historical levels where we've been allocating in the past as far under the program before we were reaching the cap. Mm-hmm. So, this is a really important piece of legislation for affordable housing projects in Oregon, and it takes a couple of years to get it up and running, and since, so we're at the cap now, so we need this increase now, and that's also the reason we need the sunset extended so we don't end up getting another pinch in the system a couple of years down the road. So in closing, it's a really vital program for our state and for our ability to meet the housing needs of our low-income residents here. And again, it's one of the few tools that we have in our arsenal to reach those lower-income populations. And the benefit is job creation, affordable housing, and it does that with a significant amount of private capital.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Mendeley? Mr. Croft.
Thank you. Good morning.
We're getting up against the time crunch a little bit here.
Okay, I think I can be pretty brief. You should have a two-page handout from me and some photographs of Southview Terrace Apartments and a large family duplex triplex project. I'm Jerry Croft, the director of Salem Housing Authority. Back in the 1990s, I was engaged in housing development for my agency, and on two occasions I used what we used to call the Oregon Lender Tax Credit. It's now the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit. Let me walk you through Southview Terrace Apartments. First, it is a 60-unit property for seniors located here in Salem. It was constructed in 1993. I've listed the development financing features of this property. First of all, there's a loan from Wells Fargo Bank. This was also a low-income housing tax credit, so it coupled that form of financing with the Oregon Lender Tax Credit. A loan from the Housing Authority, a grant from the City of Salem, and some energy rebate from PGE. The features that I'd like to point out are that we did achieve below market rents at the property. One of the main reasons that we did that was because of the Oregon Lender Tax Credit. That's responsible for about $51 per unit per month of that additional affordability. The other things I'd like to point out, in the table at the bottom, I've noted that the required income for residents of this property is about $2,000 per year less than it would be without the affordable credit. And what that does is expand the band. We have an upper limit of 60% of median income required to be eligible to live at the property, and we've reduced the lower limit from about 43% down to 37%. So that's a greater number of people that can be eligible to reside at the property. Another point I'd like to make is that some residents living at South View Terrace use the voucher, the housing choice voucher, in the event that they have income that's still below these levels, and that by having a market rate, a rent at the property that is below market, we stretch those voucher dollars considerably by having a lower starting point for those that rent cost. The fifth point I'd like to make with regard to this program at Southview Terrace is that since we've coupled it with the low-income housing tax credit, we have a 50-year obligation to keep the rents affordable, and the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit will carry forward and have that lower rent for 50 years, even though the loan term is only 20 years long.
Thank you.
Okay.
Any questions for Mr. Croft?
Quick question.
Yeah, please, Senator Przanski.
Mr. Croft, where is the Southview Terrace apartment?
Southview Terrace is located on Fairview Avenue. If you drive out Commercial Street South at Fairview, I think there's a Buster's Barbecue right immediately east of that. Just down the hill on Fairview is where Southview Terrace is located.
Thank you.
And half our colleagues, you know, because of the income requirements, actually can live at Southview.
Down the block from me.
Yeah.
I showed the property to my mother recently, and she was very proud of it, and she said that's some place she might like to live someday.
Oh, good. Oh, well, that'd be nice for a project that you helped develop. Other thoughts or questions? Appreciate. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Van Vliet.
Thank you, Chair.
Anyone else on 996? Yes. Oh, yes, sir. You guys are on my list that's in this paper. Please, Eugene Oregon is coming to the...
Richie and Jean.
...to the dais.
Two for the price of one.
Yeah, that's good. We like Eugene.
We love Eugene.
He loves Eugene.
I'll start this time. My name again is Jean Tate. I live in Eugene. I am a nonprofit developer, and I'm an unpaid nonprofit developer. I do this as volunteer since my field was real estate years ago. We have built, my organization, Metropolitan Affordable Housing, has built a number of projects in the Eugene area. Our first project did not have the OAHTC. Our second project did. We were able to lower rents in the second project, Greenleaf Village, to accommodate people at the 40% of median income instead of over 50. Because of that, my first project, Woodleaf Village, has a waiting list of about 60. Our project with a lower lower rental rates has a waiting list over 150 for the 34 units that we have. Huh. It's a very valuable project. I hope you can continue it.
Yeah, well, we're really interested.
40% is like 12,000 some.
Yeah, around 12,500 a year for a family of three.
For the incomes. So as a developer, you're looking at, you'd like to do a project. What do you call Bob Repine's office and say, well, we're looking at this project. We like the lender's tax credit as part of it. Or I don't know if you talked to Noah. I guess give us a brief sense of how you compile the tax credits and other
We do it two ways. We look at it without the OAHTC, and we look at it with, and we can do it either way, but we cannot have the low rents. And so we, if you renew it, obviously, we can do the lower rents.
Just different
lower
folks
rates.
Will mm-hmm. live
yeah,
in the unit.
You service different folks.
Great, great. That's compelling. Yes, sir.
And what I'll say is I'm with the city of Eugene. We've been experiencing a housing crisis for 15, 20 years. In 1990, we could count about 20,000 households that were eligible for subsidized housing. In the 2000 census, it was 10,000 households in 1990. Now it's 20,000 households. But the number of affordable housing units isn't anywhere near keeping up with the increase in people who need them. So we have about 4,000 people assisted out of 20,000 that are eligible. That's a pretty big gap. And that means that those people who are not assisted are paying well over 30% of their income on housing, many of them over 50 or 75% of their income on housing, and that puts them at high risk. And the indirect costs to our community are significant. We see it spilling out in public safety issues, in public health issues, and absolutely in public education issues. So there's an enormous cost, and what we see is rents and the market rents continue to escalate. And we have, as a city, been very committed to addressing low-income housing issues. And we believe that children who are in school deserve to have safe places to live and affordable places to live. And we've used about every local tool at our disposal, property tax exemptions. We use our block grant to purchase land. We give it to developers for free. We put in home money. We get the county to put in road funds, so they put in the roads for the low-income housing project subdivisions for free. You name it, we've tried it, and I don't think anybody's done more of it than we have. And what we're asking for is basically to have the state be a partner with us. Our results have been terrific. The projects that we have gotten built by our developers like Metropolitan Affordable Housing and others have been fabulous developments and have been really assets to their neighborhoods, and we do them all over town. We have a dispersal policy all over town. But it's just not enough, and we need this particular tool. And to add to the comments that were made before, it's not unusual because of all the complications of putting a low-income housing project together that has 7 or 8 different subsidies. For it to take 4 or 5 years from conception to construction, it took six. Right. It's not unusual at all. And so having a short sunset, it just creates really a lot of difficulty. So I really encourage you to put this out there a ways because it's a great program.
There's no dash ones on this one.
Yeah, great. Thank you very much.
Senator Brzezinski.
Mr. Chair, I just want to comment. Jean Tate could have basically retired. She was very successful in the real estate business as an agent and broker. But she's put her energy and continues to put her energy back in the community for low-income housing. Hmm. And she's done, as she says in her projects, and really have made a mark. And as Richie Wyman says, the city's taken on a position that we're not going to basically sectored off a portion of the community for all this type of development. It's diverse throughout the communities, and it's really, I think, the best way for this type of developments to go, because you actually give that cross-section where everyone has the ability to live in the same areas and experience those quality of lives. And, you know, for Jean, I really want to thank her for coming up here and giving her 2 cents worth, because her commitment to the community, you know, really shows what other, I think, people have done throughout the state and their communities.
That's true. It's very true.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I will add that Eugene has one of the best parking enforcement. it ranks right up there with Salem in terms of parking fee enforcement programs.
Right underneath.
I ride my bicycle and walk to work almost every day for that very reason.
wise call. Okay, John, are you going to... John Blatt, who was going to testify, and we ran out of time, so he will bring us home. And while John gets situated, I think we're ready for a floor vote count on this bill and get a sense of the committee. But I think this committee feels pretty good about this program, so I think we're ready for a floor vote count. John.
Great. Thank you. Members of the committee, my name is John Blatt. I'm with the Association of Oregon Community Development Organizations. I have with me Diana Satanovich from Linn County Affordable Housing and Jamie Bishop, who's a resident of one of Diana's projects. I'm going to actually turn it over to Diana to talk a little bit from the developer standpoint and then to Jamie to talk about this program from a resident standpoint.
Well, I want to thank you very much for listening to us, and I hope to respect your time because I know you're in a hurry. I don't often speak for other people, but in this regard, I need to say that on behalf of my peers, my fellow developers throughout the state, Terry McDonald from St. Vincent de Paul and Eugene, Rita Grady from the Polk CDC, and some other people who just walked out. the thing is that this is one of the most concerning resource items for us as rural developers. We hear people talk in the urban areas, and we try not to be jealous, but, you know, the cities are able to bring some resources to the table. And in rural Oregon, where you have cities like in my area, Lebanon and Sweet Home, who are struggling with 50% of the population being at low and moderate income, and they are just now learning to raise their SDCs and raise their other fees to meet their own costs, and the county not being able to bring resources forward, we bring a project to the State Housing Department you know, maybe less than 17% in all of our projects comes from grant sources. The rest of it has to come from low-income housing tax credits, conventional lending, and to be honest with you, if we did not have access to the OHTCs, we would not be able to do projects in the poor areas of rural Oregon because we cannot meet the rents. You know, an example is that 48 of the 92 units we have in Lenovo and Sweet Home are multifamily by definition, but they house 50% of the population of those projects is all elderly and disabled people. And disability income for on an annual basis is $6,000. That's $500 a month. 50% of that person's income is $250. We cannot get those rents down to $250, pay the mortgage, pay the groundskeeper, pay the property manager, pay the maintenance, pay the turnovers, and we literally do not bring things home from those projects to pay our own operations. And so without the OHTCs to bring the interest rate down, to keep the mortgage manageable, we could not do the projects. And now we're looking at increases to cost, development costs, because the cities need to raise their fees to make development possible for themselves. Interest rates are going up. The housing authority is seeing a reduction to subsidy available to very low-income people, so people are having to pay a little more, even with Section 8. So we're seeing costs going up, including interest rates, so it becomes even more vital that we have access to a 4% reduction in our interest rate to keep the mortgage down to pay the costs and keep the rents. And with regard to the monitoring issue, I wanted to say a quick thing about that. I would invite you, and I will be happy to provide you a copy of the CFC, the Consolidated Funding Application, to show you how diligent our housing office is with regard to both ensuring that the pass-through is committed from the outset and monitoring that the pass-through is kept through the 30-year period of commitment to affordability.
So you felt airtight.
Airtight, yes. It squeaks. Yeah. And someone mentioned the business about, I think Bill mentioned how really you get a little bit more bang for your buck than the actual commitment, because none of us are going to go right up to the edge. We always have a cushion because we have turnover and we have to keep our rents affordable to the income of that family coming in. We're always going to keep a cushion in there. So you do get more than the initial commitment to the OHTCs out of the real return. And one thing that really is important to understand, I think, is that we're talking about a 30-year commitment to affordability. So that is in, without doing all the math, that is an incredible bang for your buck. So I'm going to now, in interest of time, turn this over to Jamie, who lives in our first project, which was built in 1996. And I think Jamie is an incredible success story about how affordable housing can help people move on with their life.
And where is that project?
It's in Lebanon. It's called Lebanon. Carolina Court. Okay. And we just repainted it.
Oh.
It was at a healthy cost.
Yes.
Thank you, Diana. My name is Jamie Bishop, and I live in Carolina Court in Lebanon. It's an affordable housing property. I recently, over the last year, transitioned from welfare back to the workforce. I'm a single mother of three very small children, and I work 40 hours a week. Over 50% of my income goes directly to daycare costs. Without the affordable rent that I pay, I would still be living in a very small studio, which is where I was before I moved into Carolina Court, which is not easy with three little children. Also, I've been able to put away a little bit of money, and I'm now looking towards buying my first home in the very near future. And none of this is anything I could have done had I been trying to pay market rate rent and give my children a safe, affordable home that they could take pride in and prosper in. And so the affordable housing program is very near and dear to my heart.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you for coming to the Capitol today. Your stories are very, very poignant for us to hear, to see the faces of when we enact it. It's a lot of numbers here, and to hear personal stories, it's really helpful.
Thank you.
Questions, Senator Brzezinski?
Thank you. If you don't want to answer this, you don't need to, but you mentioned that half of your income goes to daycare cost. Can you tell us a little bit more about what that cost entails and if there's any assistance that you get for that?
Yes. My daycare costs are $1,100 a month, and I pay $800 of that out of my pocket. I make about $1,400 a month, so it's a pretty big chunk.
Yes, it is.
So it's
I wouldn't be able to work if I had to pay market rate rent. I would have to stay on welfare.
Right. And the program that you have, is this through a individual sitter, or are you at some type of center?
It's a daycare provider, but it's pretty typical. I priced them, looked around, and she's very comfortable and very good.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, that's very, very helpful for us to hear. I'm at least looking at this. Senator George, any thoughts or comments? John, thank you for bringing us also a rural perspective. Too much of this concentrates on Portland, and this is a statewide issue, and so it's helpful to see the statewide implications. Appreciate that.
Well, that's great. Yeah, because these projects really wouldn't get developed in rural areas, and the economic impacts of these developments are even more pronounced in rural communities. We had a study done a couple of years ago of the economic impact of just our membership developments. And they came up between 90 and 92. We had supported 12,200 full-time construction jobs during that time period, half of those in rural areas, probably half of those in metropolitan areas. And we paid out probably $393 million in wages over 12 years. So these have a real significant impact on the economy. And as you can tell from Jamie's story, has a huge impact on her life and her quality of life.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you very much, Jamie, for coming. You made a big impact on us.
Thank you.
Anyone else on? So we'll bring this bill back for a work session relatively soon. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 996, and we are adjourned.